He was told, someday she will be pregnant, someday she will have a baby, and having a baby is, on the whole, one of the most exciting and conspicuous achievements that can be presented to the eyes of small children in these simple worlds, in some of which the largest buildings are only 15 feet high, the largest boat some 20 feet long. Furthermore, the little girl learns that she will have a baby, not because she is strong or energetic or initiating, not because she works and struggles and tries and in the end succeeds, but simply because she is a girl and not a boy, and girls turn into women, and in the end, if they protect their femininity, have babies. To an American woman in the 20th century competing in a field which demands initiative and energy and work, and in which men resent her success, to a woman with less will and ability to compete than Margaret Mead, how tempting is her vision of the South Sea world, where a woman succeeds and is envied by man just by being a woman. In our Occidental view of life, woman, fashioned from man's rib, can at the most strive unsuccessfully to imitate man's superior powers and higher vocations. The basic theme of the initiatory cult, however, is that women, by virtue of their ability to make children, hold the secret of life. Man's role is uncertain, undefined, and perhaps unnecessary. By a great effort, man has hit upon a method of compensating himself for his basic inferiority. Equipped with various mysterious noise-making instruments, whose potency rests upon their actual forms being unknown to those who hear the sounds, that is, the women and children must never know that they are really bamboo flutes or hollow logs, they can get the male children away from the women, brand them as incomplete, and themselves turn boys into men. Women, it is true, make human beings, but only men can make men. True, this primitive society was a shaky structure protected by endless taboos and precautions, by women's shame, fluttery fear, indulgence of male vanity, and it survived only as long as everyone kept the rules. The missionary who shows the flutes to the women has broken the culture successfully. But Margaret Mead, who might have shown American men and women the flutes of their own arbitrary and shaky taboos, precautions, shames, fears, and indulgence of male vanity, did not use her knowledge in this way. Out of life the way it was, in Samoa, Bali, where all men envied women, she held up an ideal for American women that gave new reality to the shaky structure of sexual prejudice, the feminine mystique. The language is anthropological, the theory stated as fact is Freudian, but the yearning is for a return to the Garden of Eden. A garden where women need only forget the divine discontent born of education to return to a world in which male achievement becomes merely a poor substitute for childbearing. The recurrent problem of civilization is to define the male role satisfactorily enough, whether it be to build gardens or raise cattle, kill game or kill enemies, build bridges or handle bank shares, so that the male may, in the course of his life, reach a solid sense of irreversible achievement of which his childhood knowledge of the satisfactions of childbearing has given him a glimpse. In the case of women, it is only necessary that they be permitted by the given social arrangements to fulfill their biological role, to attain this sense of irreversible achievement. If women are to be restless and questing, even in the face of childbearing, they must be made so through education. What the feminine mystique took from Margaret Mead was not her vision of woman's great untested human potential, but this glorification of the female sexual function that has indeed been tested in every culture, but seldom in civilized cultures, valued as highly as the unlimited potential of human creativity, so far mainly displayed by man. The vision the mystique took from Margaret Mead was of a world where women, by merely being women and bearing children, will earn the same respect accorded men for their creative achievements, as if possession of uterus and breasts bestows on women a glory that men can never know, even though they labor all their lives to create. In such a world, all the other things that a woman can do or be are merely pale substitutes for the conception of a child. Femininity becomes more than its definition by society. It becomes a value which society must protect from the destructive onrush of civilization, like the vanishing buffalo. Margaret Mead's eloquent pages made a great many American women envy the serene femininity of a bare-breasted Samoan and try to make themselves into languorous savages, breasts unfettered by civilization's brassieres and brains undisturbed by pallid man-made knowledge of the goals of human progress. Women's biological career line has a natural climax structure that can be overlaid, muted, muffled, and publicly denied, but which remains as an essential element in both sexes' view of themselves. The young Balinese girl to whom one says, "Your name is Itewa," and who draws herself up and answers, "I am Menbawa," mother of Bawa, is speaking absolutely. She is the mother of Bawa. Bawa may die tomorrow, but she remains the mother of Bawa. Only if he had died unnamed would her neighbors have called her Menbalasin, mother bereft. Stage after stage in women's life histories thus stand, irrevocable, indisputable, accomplished. This gives a natural basis for the little girl's emphasis on being rather than on doing. The little boy learns that he must act like a boy, do things, prove that he is a boy, and prove it over and over again, while the little girl learns that she is a girl, and all she has to do is to refrain from acting like a boy. And so it goes, on and on, until one is inclined to say, "So what? You are born, you grow, you are impregnated, you have a child, it grows." This is true of all cultures, recorded or unrecorded, the one we know from life, and the recondite ones which only the far-traveled anthropologist knows. But is this all there is to life for a woman today? It is not to deny the importance of biology to question a definition of woman's nature that is based so completely on her biological difference from man. Female biology, woman's biological career line, may be changeless, the same in Stone Age women 20,000 years ago, and Samoan women on remote islands, and American women in the 20th century, but the nature of the human relationship to biology has changed. Our increasing knowledge, the increasing potency of human intelligence, has given us an awareness of purposes and goals beyond the simple biological needs of hunger, thirst, and sex. Even these simple needs in men or women today are not the same as they were in the Stone Age or in the South Sea cultures, because they are now part of a more complex pattern of human life. As an anthropologist, of course, Margaret Mead knew this. And for all her words glorifying the female role, there are other words picturing the wonders of a world in which women would be able to realize their full capabilities. But this picture is almost invariably overlaid with the therapeutic caution, the manipulative superiority typical of too many American social scientists. When this caution is combined with perhaps an over-evaluation of the power of social science not merely to interpret culture and personality, but to order our lives, her words acquire the aura of a righteous crusade, a crusade against change. She joins the other functional social scientists in their emphasis on adjusting to society as we find it, on living our lives within the framework of the conventional cultural definitions of the male and female roles. This attitude is explicit in the later pages of Male and Female. Giving each sex its due, a full recognition of its special vulnerabilities and needs for protection, means looking beyond the superficial resemblances during the period of later childhood, when both boys and girls, each having laid many of the problems of sex adjustment aside, seem so eager to learn and so able to learn the same things. But every adjustment that minimizes a difference, a vulnerability, in one sex, a differential strength in the other, diminishes their possibility of complementing each other, and corresponds, symbolically, to sealing off the constructive receptivity of the female and the vigorous outgoing constructive activity of the male, muting them both, in the end, to a duller version of human life, in which each is denied the fullness of humanity that each might have had. No human gift is strong enough to flower fully in a person who is threatened with loss of sex membership. No matter with what goodwill we may embark on a program of actually rearing both men and women to make their full and special contributions in all the complex processes of civilization, medicine and law, education and religion, the arts and sciences, the task will be very difficult. It is of very doubtful value to enlist the gifts of women if bringing women into fields that have been defined as male frightens the men, unsexes the women, muffles and distorts the contribution the women could make, either because their presence excludes men from the occupation or because it changes the quality of the men who enter it. It is folly to ignore the signs which warn us that the present terms in which women are lured by their own curiosities and drives developed under the same educational system as boys are bad for both men and women. The role of Margaret Mead as the professional spokesman of femininity would have been less important if American women had taken the example of her own life instead of listening to what she said in her books. Margaret Mead has lived a life of open challenge and lived it proudly and sometimes self-consciously as a woman. She has moved on the frontiers of thought and added to the superstructure of our knowledge. She has demonstrated feminine capabilities that go far beyond childbirth. She made her way in what was still very much a man's world without denying that she was a woman. In fact, she proclaimed in her work a unique woman's knowledge with which no male anthropologist could compete. After so many centuries of unquestioned masculine authority, how natural for someone to proclaim a feminine authority. But the great human visions of stopping wars, curing sickness, teaching races to live together, building new and beautiful structures for people to live in, are more than other ways of having children. It is not easy to combat age-old prejudices. As a social scientist and as a woman, she struck certain blows against the prejudicial image of woman that may long outlast her own life. In her insistence that women are human beings, unique human beings, not men with something missing, she went a step beyond Freud. And yet, because her observations were based on Freud's bodily analogies, she cut down her own vision of women by glorifying the mysterious miracle of femininity, which a woman realizes simply by being female, letting the breast grow and the menstrual blood flow and the baby suck from the swollen breast. In her warning that women who seek fulfillment beyond their biological role are in danger of becoming desexed witches, she spelled out again an unnecessary choice. She persuaded younger women to give up part of their dearly won humanity rather than lose their femininity. In the end, she did the very thing that she warned against, recreating in her work the vicious circle that she broke in her own life. We may go up the scale from simple physical differences through complementary distinctions that overstress the role of sex difference and extend it inappropriately to other aspects of life, to stereotypes of such complex activities as those involved in the formal use of the intellect, in the arts, in government, and in religion. In all these complex achievements of civilization, those activities which are mankind's glory and upon which depends our hope of survival in this world that we have built, there has been this tendency to make artificial definitions that limit an activity to one sex, and by denying the actual potentialities of human beings, limit not only both men and women, but also equally the development of the activity itself. Here is a vicious circle to which it is not possible to assign either a beginning or an end, in which men's overestimation of women's roles or women's overestimation of men's roles leads one sex or the other to arrogate, to neglect, or even to relinquish part of our so dearly won humanity. Those who would break the circle are themselves a product of it, express some of its defects in their every gesture, may be only strong enough to challenge it, not able to actually break it. Yet, once identified, once analyzed, it should be possible to create a climate of opinion in which others, a little less the product of the dark past, because they have been reared with a light in their hand that can shine backwards as well as forwards, may in turn take the next step. Perhaps the feminine protest was a necessary step after the masculine protest made by some of the feminists. Margaret Mead was one of the first women to emerge into prominence in American life after rights for women were won. Her mother was a social scientist, her grandmother a teacher. She had private images of women who were fully human. She had education equal to any man's. And she was able to say with conviction, "It's good to be a woman. You don't need to copy man. You can respect yourself as a woman." She made a resounding feminine protest in her life and in her work. And it was a step forward when she influenced emancipated modern women to choose, with free intelligence, to have babies, bear them with a proud awareness that denied pain, nurse them at the breast, and devote mind and body to their care. It was a step forward in the passionate journey, and one made possible by it, for educated women to say yes to motherhood as a conscious, human purpose, and not a burden imposed by the flesh. For, of course, the natural childbirth breastfeeding movement Margaret Mead helped inspire was not at all a return to primitive earth mother maternity. It appealed to the independent, educated, spirited American woman and to her counterparts in Western Europe and Russia because it enabled her to experience childbirth not as a mindless female animal, an object manipulated by the obstetrician, but as a whole person able to control her own body with her aware mind. Perhaps less important than birth control and the other rights which made woman more equal to man, the work of Margaret Mead helped humanize sex. It took a scientific super saleswoman to recreate in modern American life even a semblance of the conditions under which primitive tribesmen jealously imitated maternity and bled themselves. The modern husband goes through the breathing exercises with his wife as she prepares for natural childbirth. But did she oversell women? It was perhaps not her fault that she was taken so literally that procreation became a cult, a career, to the exclusion of every other kind of creative endeavor, until women kept on having babies because they knew no other way to create. She was often quoted out of context by the lesser functionalists in the women's magazines. Those who found in her work confirmation of their own unadmitted prejudices and fears ignored not only the complexity of her total work, but the example of her complex life. With all the difficulties she must have encountered, pioneering as a woman in the realm of abstract thought that was the domain of man, a one-sentence review of Sex and Temperament indicates the resentment she often met. "Margaret, have you found a culture yet where the men had the babies?" She had never retreated from the hard road to self-realization so few women have traveled since. She told women often enough to stay on that road. If they only heard her other words of warning and conformed to her glorification of femininity, perhaps it was because they were not as sure of themselves and their human abilities as she was. Margaret Mead and the lesser functionalists knew the pains, the risks, of breaking through age-old social strictures. This awareness was their justification for qualifying their statements of women's potentiality with the advice that women not compete with men, but seek respect for their uniqueness as women. It was hardly revolutionary advice. It did not upset the traditional image of woman any more than Freudian thought upset it. Perhaps it was their intention to subvert the old image, but instead they gave the new mystique its scientific authority. Ironically, Margaret Mead in the 1960s began to voice alarm at the return of the cave woman, the retreat of American women to narrow domesticity while the world trembled on the brink of technological holocaust. In an excerpt from a book entitled American Women, The Changing Image, which appeared in the Saturday Evening Post, March 3, 1962, she asked, "Why have we returned, despite our advances in technology, to the Stone Age picture? Woman has gone back, each to her separate cave, waiting anxiously for her mate and children to return, guarding her mate jealously against other women, almost totally unaware of any life outside her door. In this retreat into fecundity, it is not the individual woman who is to blame. It is the climate of opinion that has developed in this country." Apparently, Margaret Mead does not acknowledge or perhaps recognize her own role as a major architect of that climate of opinion. Apparently, she has overlooked much of her own work, which helped persuade several generations of able modern American women in desperate cavewoman style to devote their whole lives to narrow domesticity, first in schoolgirl dreaming and a search for roles which make them appealingly ignorant, then as mothers and then as grandmothers, restricting their activities to the preservation of their own private and often boring existences. Even though it would seem that Margaret Mead is now trying to get women out of the home, she still ascribes a sexual specialness to everything a woman does. Trying to seduce them into the modern world of science as the teacher mothers of infant scientists, she is still translating the new possibilities open to women and the new problems facing them as members of the human race into sexual terms. But now, those roles which have historically belonged to women are stretched to include political responsibility for nuclear disarmament, to cherish not just their own, but the children of the enemy. Since, beginning with the same premise and examining the same body of anthropological evidence, she now arrives at a slightly different sexual role for women. One might seriously question the basis upon which she decides the roles a woman should play, and finds it so easy to change the rules of the game from one decade to the next. Other social scientists have arrived at the astonishing conclusion that being a woman was no more and no less than being human. But a cultural lag is built into the feminine mystique. By the time a few social scientists were discovering the flaws in woman's role, American educators had seized upon it as a magic sesame. Instead of educating women for the greater maturity required to participate in modern society, with all the problems, conflicts, and hard work involved for educators as well as women, they began educating them to play the role of woman. Chapter 7. The Sex-Directed Educators. It must have been going on for 10 or 15 years before the educators even suspected it. The old-fashioned educators, that is. The new sex-directed educators were surprised that anyone should be surprised, shocked that anyone should be shocked. The shock, the mystery, to the naive who had great hopes for the higher education of women, was that more American women than ever before were going to college. But fewer of them were going on from college to become physicists, philosophers, poets, doctors, lawyers, stateswomen, social pioneers, even college professors. Fewer women in recent college graduating classes have gone on to distinguish themselves in a career or profession than those in the classes graduated before World War II, the Great Divide. Fewer and fewer college women were preparing for any career or profession requiring more than the most casual commitment. Two out of three girls who entered college were dropping out before they even finished. In the 1950s, those who stayed, even the most able, showed no signs of wanting to be anything more than suburban housewives and mothers. In fact, to professors at Vassar and Smith and Barnard, resorting to desperate means to arouse students' interest in anything college could teach them, the girls seemed suddenly incapable of any ambition, any vision, any passion, except the pursuit of a wedding ring. In this pursuit, they seemed almost desperate, as early as freshman year. Out of loyalty to that more and more futile illusion, the importance of higher education for women, the purest professors kept quiet at first. But the disuse of, the resistance to, higher education by American women finally began to show in the statistics. In the departure of the male presidents, scholars, and educators from women's colleges, in the disillusionment, the mystified frustration or cool cynicism of the ones who stayed, and in the skepticism, finally, in colleges and universities about the value of a professorial investment in any girl or woman, no matter how apparently able and ambitious. Some women's colleges went out of business. Some professors at coeducational universities said one out of three college places should no longer be wasted on women. The president of Sarah Lawrence, a women's college with high intellectual values, spoke of opening the place to men. The president of Vassar predicted the end of all the great American women's colleges which pioneered higher education for women. When I read the first cautious hints of what was happening in the preliminary report of the Psychological, Sociological, Anthropological Mellon Foundation study of Vassar girls in 1956, I thought, my, how Vassar must have deteriorated. Strong commitment to any activity or career other than that of housewife is rare. Many students, perhaps a third, are interested in graduate schooling and in careers, for example, teaching. Few, however, plan to continue with a career if it should conflict with family needs. As compared to previous periods, however, for example, the feminist era, few students are interested in the pursuit of demanding careers, such as law or medicine, regardless of personal or social pressures. Similarly, one finds few instances of people, like Edna St. Vincent Millay, individuals completely committed to their art by the time of adolescence and resistant to any attempts to tamper with it. A later report elaborated, Vassar students are further convinced that the wrongs of society will gradually right themselves with little or no direct intervention on the part of women college students. Vassar girls, by and large, do not expect to achieve fame, make an enduring contribution to society, pioneer any frontiers, or otherwise create ripples in the placid order of things. Not only is spinsterhood viewed as a personal tragedy, but offspring are considered essential to the full life, and the Vassar student believes that she would willingly adopt children if it were necessary to create a family. In short, her future identity is largely encompassed by the projected role of wife-mother. In describing the qualities to be found in an ideal husband, the majority of Vassa girls are quite explicit in their preference for the man who will assume the most important role, that is, handle his own career and make the majority of decisions affecting matters outside the home. That the female should attempt, in their thinking, to usurp the prerogatives of the male is a distasteful notion which would seriously disrupt their own projected role of helpmate and faithful complement to the man of the house. I saw the change, a very real one, when I went back to my own college in 1959 to live for a week with the students in a campus house at Smith, and then went on to interview girls from colleges and universities all over the United States. A beloved psychology professor, on the eve of his retirement, complained, "They're bright enough. They have to be to get here at all now. But they just won't let themselves get interested. They seem to feel it will get in their way when they marry the young executive and raise all those children in the suburbs. I couldn't schedule the final seminar for my senior honor students. Too many kitchen showers interfered. None of them considered the seminar sufficiently important to postpone their kitchen showers." He's exaggerating, I thought. I picked up a copy of the college newspaper I had once edited. The current student editor described a government class in which 15 of the 20 girls were knitting with the stony-faced concentration of Madame Defarge. The instructor, more in challenge than in seriousness, announced that Western civilization is coming to an end. The students turned to their notebooks and wrote, "Western civ coming to an end," all without dropping a stitch. Why do they need such baiting? I wondered. Remembering how we used to stand around after class, arguing about what the professor had said. Economic theory, political philosophy, the history of Western civilization, sociology 21, science and the imagination, even Chaucer. "What courses are people excited about now?" I asked a blonde senior in cap and gown. "Nuclear physics, maybe? Modern art? The civilizations of Africa?" Looking at me as if I were some prehistoric dinosaur, she said, "Girls don't get excited about things like that anymore. We don't want careers. Our parents expect us to go to college. Everybody goes. You're a social outcast at home if you don't. But a girl who got serious about anything she studied, like wanting to go on and do research, would be peculiar, unfeminine. I guess everybody wants to graduate with a diamond ring on her finger. That's the important thing." I discovered an unwritten rule barring shop talk about courses, intellectual talk, in some college houses. On the campus, the girls looked as if they were in such a hurry, rushing. Nobody except a few faculty members sat around talking in the coffee dives or the corner drugstore. We used to sit for hours arguing what is truth, art for art's sake, religion, sex, war and peace, Freud and Marx, and all the things that were wrong with the world. A cool junior told me, "We never waste time like that. We don't have bull sessions about abstract things. Mostly we talk about our dates. Anyhow, I spend 3 days a week off campus. There's a boy I'm interested in. I want to be with him." A dark-eyed senior in a raincoat admitted, as a kind of secret addiction, that she liked to wander around the stacks in the library and pick up books that interest me. You learn freshman year to turn up your nose at the library. Lately, though, well, it hits you that you won't be at college next year. Suddenly you wish you'd read more, talked more, taken hard courses you skipped. So you know what you're interested in. But I guess those things don't matter when you're married. You're interested in your home and teaching your children how to swim and skate, and at night you talk to your husband. I think we'll be happier than college women used to be. These girls behaved as if college were an interval to be gotten through impatiently, efficiently, bored, but businesslike, so real life could begin. And real life was when you married and lived in a suburban house with your husband and children. Was it quite natural, this boredom, this businesslike haste? Was it real, this preoccupation with marriage? The girls who glibly disclaimed any serious interest in their education with talk of, "When I married," often were not seriously interested in any particular man, I discovered. The ones who were rushing to get their college work done, to spend 3 days a week off campus, sometimes had no real date they wanted to keep. In my time, popular girls who spent many weekends at Yale were often just as serious about their work as the brains. Even if you were temporarily or quite seriously in love during the week at college, you lived the life of the mind and found it absorbing, demanding, sometimes exciting, always real. Could these girls who now must work so much harder, have so much more ability to get into such a college against the growing competition, really be so bored with the life of the mind? Gradually, I sensed the tension, the almost sullen protest, the deliberate effort, or effort deliberately avoided, behind their cool facades. Their boredom was not quite what it seemed. It was a defense, a refusal to become involved. As a woman who unconsciously thinks sex is a sin is not there, is somewhere else, as she goes through the motions of sex, so these girls are somewhere else. They go through the motions, but they defend themselves against the impersonal passions of mind and spirit that college might instill in them, the dangerous, non-sexual passions of the intellect. A pretty sophomore explained to me, "The idea is to be casual, very sophisticated. Don't be too enthusiastic about your work or anything. People who take things too seriously are more or less pitied or laughed at, like wanting to sing. Being so intent about it, you make other people uncomfortable. An oddball." Another girl elaborated, "They might feel sorry for you. I think you can be serious about your work and not be looked down upon as a total intellectual if you stop now and then and think, 'Isn't this too hysterical?' Because you do it with tongue-in-cheek, it's okay." A girl with a fraternity pin on her pink sweater said, "Maybe we should take it more seriously. But nobody wants to graduate and get into something where they can't use it. If your husband is going to be an organization man, you can't be too educated. The wife is awfully important for the husband's career. You can't be too interested in art or something like that." A girl who dropped out of honors in history told me, "I loved it. I got so excited about my work, I would sometimes go into the library at 8 in the morning and not come out until 10 at night. I even thought I might want to go into graduate school or law school and really use my mind. Suddenly, I was afraid of what would happen. I wanted to lead a rich, full life. I want to marry, have children, have a nice house. Suddenly, I felt, what am I beating my brains out for? So this year, I'm trying to lead a well-rounded life. I take courses, but I don't read 8 books and still feel like reading the 9th. I stop and go to the movies. The other way was harder and more exciting. I don't know why I stopped. Maybe I just lost courage." The phenomenon doesn't seem confined to any particular college. One finds it among the girls in any college or department of a college, which still exposes students to the life of the mind. A junior from a southern university said, "Ever since I was a little girl, science has had a fascination for me. I was going to major in bacteriology and go into cancer research. Now I've switched to home economics. I realized that I want to go into something that deep. If I went on, I'd have been one of those dedicated people. I got so caught up in the first 2 years, I never got out of the laboratory. I loved it, but I was missing so many things. If the girls were off swimming in the afternoon, I'd be working on my smears and slides. There aren't any girls in bacteriology here, 60 boys and me in the lab. I couldn't get on with the girls anymore who don't understand science. I'm not so intensely interested in home economics as I was in bacteriology, but I realized it was better for me to change and get out with people. I realized I shouldn't be that serious. I'll go home and work in a department store until I get married." The mystery to me is not that these girls defend themselves against an involvement with the life of the mind, but that educators should be mystified by their defense or blame it on the student culture, as certain educators do. The one lesson a girl could hardly avoid learning if she went to college between 1945 and 1960 was not to get interested, seriously interested, in anything besides getting married and having children, if she wanted to be normal, happy, adjusted, feminine, have a successful husband, successful children, and a normal, feminine, adjusted, successful sex life. She might have learned some of this lesson at home and some of it from the other girls in college, but she also learned it, incontrovertibly, from those entrusted with developing her critical creative intelligence, her college professors. A subtle and almost unnoticed change had taken place in the academic culture for American women in the last 15 years. The new sex direction of their educators. Under the influence of the feminine mystique, some college presidents and professors charged with the education of women had become more concerned with their students' future capacity for sexual orgasm than with their future use of trained intelligence. In fact, some leading educators of women began to concern themselves conscientiously with protecting students from the temptation to use their critical creative intelligence by the ingenious method of educating it not to be critical or creative. Thus, higher education added its weight to the process by which American women during this period were shaped increasingly to their biological function, decreasingly to the fulfillment of their individual abilities. Girls who went to college could hardly escape those bits and pieces of Freud and Margaret Mead, or avoid a course in marriage and family life with its functional indoctrination on how to play the role of woman. The new sex direction of women's education was not, however, confined to any specific course or academic department. It was implicit in all the social sciences, but more than that, it became a part of education itself, not only because the English professor or the guidance counselor or the college president read Freud and Mead, but because education was the prime target of the new mystique. The education of American girls with, or like, boys. If the Freudians and the functionalists were right, educators were guilty of defeminizing American women, of dooming them to frustration as housewives and mothers, or to celibate careers, to life without orgasm. It was a damning indictment. Many college presidents and educational theorists confessed their guilt without a murmur and fell into the sex-directed line. There were a few cries of outrage, of course, from the old-fashioned educators who still believed the mind was more important than the marriage bed. But they were often near retirement and soon to be replaced by younger, more thoroughly sex-indoctrinated teachers, or they were so wrapped up in their special subjects that they had little say in overall school policies. The general educational climate was ripe for the new sex-directed line, with its emphasis on adjustment. The old aim of education, the development of intelligence through vigorous mastery of the major intellectual disciplines, was already in disfavor among the child-centered educators. Teachers College at Columbia was a natural breeding ground for educational functionalism. As psychology and anthropology and sociology permeated the total scholarly atmosphere, education for femininity also spread from Mills, Stevens, and the finishing schools, where its basis was more traditional than theoretical, to the proudest bastions of the Women's Ivy League, the colleges which pioneered higher education for women in America and were noted for their uncompromising intellectual standards. Instead of opening new horizons and wider worlds to able women, the sex-directed educator moved in to teach them adjustment within the world of home and children. Instead of teaching truths to counter the popular prejudices of the past or critical ways of thinking against which prejudice cannot survive, the sex-directed educator handed girls a sophisticated soup of uncritical prescriptions and presentiments, far more binding on the mind and prejudicial to the future than all the traditional do's and don'ts. Most of it was done consciously and for the best of helpful reasons by educators who really believed the mystique as the social scientists handed it to them. If a male professor or college president did not find this mystique a positive comfort, a confirmation of his own prejudices, he still had no reason not to believe it. The few college presidents and professors who were women either fell into line or had their authority as teachers and as women questioned. If they were spinsters, if they had not had babies, they were forbidden by the mystique to speak as women. Modern woman, the lost sex, would forbid them even to teach. The brilliant scholar who did not marry but inspired many generations of college women to the pursuit of truth was sullied as an educator of women. She was not named president of the women's college whose intellectual tradition she carried to its highest point. The girl's education was put in the hands of a handsome, husbandly man, more suitable to indoctrinating girls for their proper feminine role. The scholar often left the women's college to head a department in a great university where the potential PhDs were safely men, for whom the lure of scholarship, the pursuit of truth, was not deemed a deterrent to sexual fulfillment. In terms of the new mystique, the woman scholar was suspect simply by virtue of being one. She was not just working to support her home. She must have been guilty of an unfeminine commitment to have kept working in her field all those hard, grinding, ill-paid years to the PhD. In self-defense, she sometimes adopted frilly blouses or another innocuous version of the feminine protest. At psychoanalytic conventions, an observer once noticed the lady analysts camouflage themselves with pretty, flowery, smartly feminine hats that would make the casual suburban housewife look positively masculine. MD or PhD, those hats and frilly blouses say, "Let nobody question our femininity." But the fact is, their femininity was questioned. One famous women's college adopted in defense the slogan, "We are not educating women to be scholars. We are educating them to be wives and mothers." The girls themselves finally got so tired of repeating the slogan in full that they abbreviated it to WHAM. In building the sex-directed curriculum, not everyone went as far as Lynn White, former president of Mills College. But if you started with the premise that women should no longer be educated like men before their role as women, you almost had to end with his curriculum, which amounted to replacing college chemistry with a course in advanced cooking. The sex-directed educator begins by accepting education's responsibility for the frustration, general and sexual, of American women. On my desk lies a letter from a young mother a few years out of college. "I have come to realize that I was educated to be a successful man and must now learn by myself to be a successful woman." The basic irrelevance of much of what passes as women's education in America could not be more compactly phrased. The failure of our educational system to take into account these simple and basic differences between the life patterns of average men and women is at least in part responsible for the deep discontent and restlessness which affects millions of women. It would seem that if women are to restore their self-respect, they must reverse the tactics of the older feminism, which indignantly denied inherent differences in the intellectual and emotional tendencies of men and women. Only by recognizing and insisting upon the importance of such differences can women save themselves, in their own eyes, of conviction as inferiors. The sex-directed educator equates as masculine our vastly overrated cultural creativity, our uncritical acceptance of progress as good in itself, egotistic individualism, innovation, abstract construction, quantitative thinking, of which, of course, the dread symbol is either communism or the atom bomb. Against these, equated as feminine, are the sense of persons, of the immediate, of intangible qualitative relationships, an aversion for statistics and quantities, the intuitive, the emotional, and all the forces that cherish and conserve what is good, true, beautiful, useful, and holy. A feminized higher education might include sociology, anthropology, psychology. These are studies little concerned with laurel crown genius of the strong man, praises the educational protector of femininity. They are devoted to exploring the quiet and unspectacular forces of society and of the mind. They embrace the feminine preoccupation with conserving and cherishing. It would hardly include either pure science, since abstract theory and quantitative thinking are unfeminine, or fine art, which is masculine, flamboyant, and abstract. The applied or minor arts, however, are feminine, ceramics, textiles, work shaped more by the hand than the brain. Women love beauty as much as men do, but they want a beauty connected with the processes of living. The hand is as remarkable and as worthy of respect as the brain. The sex-directed educator cites approvingly Cardinal Tisserand saying, "Women should be educated so that they can argue with their husbands." "Let us stop altogether professional training for women," he insists. "All women must be educated to be housewives. Even home economics and domestic science, as they are now taught at college, are masculine because they have been pitched at the level of professional training." Here is a truly feminine education. One may prophesy with confidence that as women begin to make their distinctive wishes felt in curricular terms, not merely will every women's college and coeducational institution offer a firm nuclear course in the family, but from it will radiate curricular series dealing with food and nutrition, textiles and clothing, health and nursing, house planning and interior decoration, garden design and applied botany, and child development. Would it be impossible to present a beginning course in foods as exciting and as difficult to work up after college as a course in post-Kantian philosophy would be? Let's abandon talk of proteins, carbohydrates, and the like, save inadvertently, as for example, when we point out that a British hyperboiled Brussels sprout is not merely inferior in flavor and texture, but in vitamin content. Why not study the theory and preparation of a Basque paella, of a well-marinated shish kebab, lamb kidneys sautéed in sherry, an authoritative curry, the use of herbs, even such simple sophistications as serving cold artichokes with fresh milk. The sex-directed educator is hardly impressed by the argument that a college curriculum should not be contaminated or diluted with subjects like cooking or manual training, which can be taught successfully at the high school level. Teach them to the girls in high school and, with greater intensity and imagination, again in college. Boys also should get some family-minded education, but not in their valuable college time. Early high school manual training is enough to enable them in future years to work happily at a bench in the garage or in the garden, surrounded by an admiring circle of children, or at the barbecue. This kind of education, in the name of life adjustment, became a fact on many campuses, high school as well as college. It was not dreamed up to turn back the growth of women, but it surely helped. When American educators finally began to investigate the waste of our national resources of creative intelligence, they found that the lost Einsteins, Schweitzers, Roosevelts, Edisons, Fords, Fermis, Frosts were feminine. Of the brightest 40% of U.S. high school graduates, only half went on to college. Of the half who stopped, 2 out of 3 were girls. When Dr. James B. Conant went across the nation to find out what was wrong with the American high school, he discovered too many students were taking easy how-to courses, which didn't really stretch their minds. Again, most of those who should have been studying physics, advanced algebra, analytic geometry, 4 years of language, and were not, were girls. They had the intelligence, the special gift which was not sex-directed, but they also had the sex-directed attitude that such studies were unfeminine. Sometimes a girl wanted to take a hard subject, but was advised by a guidance counselor or teacher that it was a waste of time. As for instance, the girl in a good Eastern high school who wanted to be an architect. Her counselor strongly advised her against applying for admission anywhere in architecture on the grounds that women are rare in that profession, and she would never get in anyhow. She stubbornly applied to 2 universities who give degrees in architecture. Both, to her amazement, accepted her. Then her counselor told her that even though she had been accepted, there was really no future for women in architecture. She would spend her life in a drafting room. She was advised to go to a junior college where the work would be much easier than in architecture and where she would learn all she needed to know when she married. The influence of sex-directed education was perhaps even more insidious on the high school level than it was in the colleges, for many girls who were subjected to it never got to college. I picked up a lesson plan for one of these life adjustment courses now taught in junior high in the suburban county where I live. Entitled, The Slick Chick, it gives functional do's and don'ts for dating to girls of 11, 12, 13, a kind of early or forced recognition of their sexual function. Though many have nothing yet with which to fill a brassiere, they are told archly not to wear a sweater without one, and to be sure to wear slips so boys can see through their skirts. It is hardly surprising that by the sophomore year, many bright girls in this high school are more than conscious of their sexual function, bored with all the subjects in school, and have no ambition other than to marry and have babies. One cannot help wondering, especially when some of these girls get pregnant as high school sophomores and marry at 15 or 16, if they have not been educated for their sexual function too soon, while their other abilities go unrecognized. This stunting of able girls from non-sexual growth is nationwide. Of the top 10% of graduates of Indiana high schools in 1955, only 15% of the boys did not continue their education. 36% of the girls did not go on. In the very years in which higher education has become a necessity for almost everyone who wants a real function in our exploding society, the proportion of women among college students has declined year by year. In the 50s, women also dropped out of college at a faster rate than the men. Only 37% of the women graduated, in contrast to 55% of the men. By the 60s, an equal proportion of boys was dropping out of college. But in this era of keen competition for college seats, the one girl who enters college for every two boys is more highly selected and less likely to be dropped from college for academic failure. Women drop out, as David Reisman says, either to marry or because they fear too much education is a marriage bar. The average age of first marriage in the last 15 years has dropped to the youngest in the history of this country, the youngest in any of the countries of the Western world, almost as young as it used to be in the so-called underdeveloped countries. In the new nations of Asia and Africa, with the advent of science and education, the marriage age of women is now rising. Today, thanks in part to the functional sex direction of women's education, the annual rate of population increase in the United States is among the highest in the world, nearly three times that of the Western European nations, nearly double Japan's, and close in the heels of Africa and India. The sex-directed educators have played a dual role in this trend. By actively educating girls to their sexual function, which perhaps they would fulfill without such education in a way less likely to prevent their growth in other directions, and by abdicating their responsibility for the education of women in the strict intellectual sense. With or without education, women are likely to fulfill their biological role and experience sexual love and motherhood. But without education, women or men are not likely to develop deep interests that go beyond biology. Education should and can make a person broad in outlook and open to new experience, independent and disciplined in his thinking, deeply committed to some productive activity, possessed of convictions based on understanding of the world and on his own integration of personality. The main barrier to such growth in girls is their own rigid preconception of woman's role, which sex-directed educators reinforce, either explicitly or by not facing their own ability and responsibility to break through it. Such a sex-directed impasse is revealed in the massive depths of that 1,000-page study, The American College, when motivational factors in college entrance are analyzed from research among 1,045 boys and 1,925 girls. The study recognizes that it is the need to be independent and find identity in society not primarily through the sex role, but through work, which makes boys grow in college. The girl's evasion of growth in college is explained by the fact that for a girl, identity is exclusively sexual. For the girl, college itself is seen, even by these scholars, not as the key to larger identity, but as a disguised outlet for sexual impulses. The identity issue for the boy is primarily an occupational-vocational question, while self-definition for the girl depends more directly on marriage. A number of differences follow from this distinction. The girl's identity centers more exclusively on her sex role. Whose wife will I be? What kind of family will we have? While the boy's self-definition forms about two nuclei, he will be a husband and father, his sexual identity. But he will also and centrally be a worker. A related difference follows and has particular importance at adolescence. The occupational identity is, by and large, an issue of personal choice that can begin early and to which all of the resources of rational and thoughtful planning can be directed. The boy can begin to think and plan for this aspect of identity early. The sexual identity, so critical for feminine development, permits no such conscious or orderly effort. It is a mysterious and romantic issue, freighted with fiction, mystique, illusion. A girl may learn certain surface skills and activities of the feminine role, but she will be thought ungraceful and unfeminine if her efforts toward femininity are too clearly conscious. The real core of feminine settlement, living in intimacy with a beloved man, is a future prospect for which there is no rehearsal. We find that boys and girls and adolescents have different approaches to the future. Boys are actively planning and testing for future work identities, apparently sifting alternatives in an effort to find the role that will fit most comfortably with their particular skills and interests, temperamental characteristics, and needs. Girls, in contrast, are absorbed much more in fantasy, particularly fantasy about boys and popularity, marriage, and love. The dream of college apparently serves as a substitute for more direct preoccupation with marriage. Girls who do not plan to go to college are more explicit in their desire to marry and have a more developed sense of their own sex role. They are more aware of and more frankly concerned with sexuality. The view of fantasy as an outlet for sexual impulses follows the general psychoanalytic conception that impulses, denied direct expression, will seek some disguised mode of gratification. Thus, it did not surprise them that 70% of freshman women at a Midwestern university answered the question, "What do you hope to get out of college?" with, among other things, "The man for me." They also interpreted answers indicating a wish to leave home, travel, and answers relating to potential occupations, which were given by half the girls as symbolizing curiosity about the sexual mysteries. College and travel are alternatives to a more open interest in sexuality. Girls who complete their schooling with high school are closer to assuming an adult sex role in early marriages, and they have more developed conceptions of their sexual impulses and sex roles. Girls who will enter college, on the other hand, will delay direct realization and settlement of sexual identity, at least for a while. During the interim, sexual energy is converted and gratified through a fantasy system that focuses on college, the glamour of college life, and the sublimation to general sensuous experience. Why do the educators view girls and only girls in such completely sexual terms? Adolescent boys also have sexual urges whose fulfillment may be delayed by college. But for boys, the educators are not concerned with sexual fantasy. They are concerned with reality. And boys are expected to achieve personal autonomy and identity by committing themselves in the sphere of our culture that is most morally worthwhile, the world of work, in which they will be acknowledged as persons with recognized achievements and potentials. Even if the boys' own vocational images and goals are not realistic in the beginning, and this study showed that they were not, the sex-directed educators recognize, for boys, that motives, goals, interests, childish preconceptions can change. They also recognize that, for most, the crucial last chance for change is in college. But apparently girls are not expected to change, nor are they given the opportunity. Even at coeducational colleges, very few girls get the same education as boys. Instead of stimulating what psychologists have suggested might be a latent desire for autonomy in the girls, the sex-directed educators simulated their sexual fantasy of fulfilling all desire for achievement, status, and identity vicariously through a man. Instead of challenging the girls' childish, rigid, parochial preconception of woman's role, they cater to it by offering them a potpourri of liberal arts courses suitable only for a wifely veneer or narrow programs such as institutional dietetics, well beneath their abilities and suitable only for a stopgap job between college and marriage. As educators themselves admit, women's college training does not often equip them to enter the business or professional world at a meaningful level, either at graduation or afterward. It is not geared to career possibilities that would justify the planning and work required for higher professional training. For women, the sex-directed educators say with approval, college is the place to find a man. Presumably, if the campus is the world's best marriage mart, as one educator remarked, both sexes are affected. On college campuses today, professor and student agree, the girls are the aggressors in the marriage hunt. The boys, married or not, are there to stretch their minds, to find their own identity, to fill out their life plan. The girls are there only to fulfill their sexual function. Research reveals that 90% or more of the rising number of campus wives who were motivated for marriage by fantasy and the need to conform are literally working their husband's way through college. The girl who quits high school or college to marry and to have a baby or to take a job to work her husband's way through is stunted from the kind of mental growth and understanding that higher education is supposed to give, as surely as child labor used to stunt the physical growth of children. She is also prevented from realistic preparation and planning for a career or a commitment that will utilize her abilities and will be of some importance to society and herself. During the period when the sex-directed educators were devoted